Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. For 30 years as of today, this is the 30th anniversary of the Visionary Activist Show, we'll be playing the very first show with wonderful James Hillman. It was a great augury to magnetize him as the very first guest. And we'll be feeling the resonance of this show teased into nutrients for us all. I love that when I first met James Hillman, we went out for dinner with other really fun people, and there was a very hip black couple from Colorado. And as James and I were talking astrology, the black couple said to their nephew, "See, you didn't know any white people knew astrology, did you?" That's a very darling, adorable. So let's weave a little context of where we are, where James Hillman is in the ancestral realm, you know, and onward, here we go. So I like inviting the beloved dead to be part of the Ouija board of directors. We call on James Hillman, double Aries, and a wonderful, wonderful being with Mars, quintile Chiron, right? To bring back wise leadership to Mars, a big theme before us. And the sun, quintile Pluto, yes, irresistibly eloquent in diving into the underworld and reporting back. When he was born, his Pluto was at 12 Cancer, which is right on top of the U.S. Sun, where the sun was when this country was founded. So yes, we need you, James, we need you, absolutely. So here we are now, as Uranus, trickster genius, is stationing, wonderfully important in James Hillman's chart. Of course, he was agent provocateur, bringer alive of things, genius. His Uranus conjoined his Mercury in retrograde, giving bold expression to old things and mythological literacy. Really great. So here we are now, Uranus stationing. Uranus, again, against all odds, trickster genius. The last ideas associated with it are democracy, equality, synchronicity. And how this guides us is, I wondered what those ideas had to do with each other, and no sooner did I wonder that than events staged themselves in such a way to make it clear when we look down or up at anybody, there's no synchronicity. When we aspire to tease democracy into every fiber of our being and our manners, you know, how we treat each other, which does not mean being nice, because nice comes from nescient, which means ignorant, but it does mean having collaborative ally manners. When we do that or aspire to do that, the rate of synchronicity increases dramatically. I have seen this. And a better phrasing might be our availability to the synchronous field is enhanced. And we go, okay, let's do that. So right now, Uranus is stationing. When a planet representing an intelligence within us and without is stationing, it really wants our attention. And it's really also about revolution. What is the revolution we need to have, we are having in some ways, you know, and that we are custodians of right now? So Uranus stations and retrogrades on September 5th in California, September 6th on the East Coast, 9:51 p.m. Pacific time, Friday, September 5th, September 6th, 12:51 a.m. East Coast time. There we go. So it really wants our attention. So let's think of revolution. And I've been watching, rewatching for the third time, the series Turn about spies in the Revolutionary War. It was the last words that my beloved ally, Bob Goff, also a member of the Ouija Board of Directors, said to me as he went out the door to go do innumerable good works, and then he died. But he said, "Do watch the series Turn." I'm like, okay, I will. I'll watch it three times. It's very compelling storytelling, very nuanced, complex, about how crucial, how important spies were. And after I watched it the first time, I Googled, was the actual American Revolution as brutal and cruel on all sides as depicted in Turn? Oh yeah. It was all revolutions, really, maybe not the revolution, we can dredge for revolutions that weren't violent and cruel, but mostly cruel. And I love what Chairman Mao said when he was asked what he thought about the French Revolution, and he said, "It's too soon to say." We go, "Oh, that's Chinese vastness, thank you, that's adorable." So, yes, so before us now, here's Uranus is stationing. It's in a powerful pattern of opportunity for us. The outer planets represent huge forces of nature's intelligence, and they are keepers of the whole big conversation, cultural and biological. So when they dance with us, and they're all dancing with all of us, they're cutting in on our dance, going, "Didn't we all come here to do something?" We did. We did. So each one has manners to invite. You know, Pluto, the deep, deep part of us, says, you know, does best with a mission. Even if we don't know what our mission is, we can wonder about it because Pluto has a beautiful 60-degree angle to Neptune and Saturn. Neptune dreams and vision. Saturn has just retrograded back into Pisces. So this whole time right now is there were many planets in Pisces, whoa, vision. Then they went into Aries, action. Now they're going back into Pisces, vision. So Saturn's at the last degree of the zodiac right now. It is retrograded back in. And it says all the esoteric teachings, all the powerful images, all the powerful music, all the prayers, all the divinatory systems that ever were or will be are here now. And it's very much like the Celtic bard Amargan, you know, about his song of becoming. It's a never-ending song. I have been the guest of 100 kings. I have been a boar in its boldness. I have been the glint of light on a wave. I've been everything. So Saturn, our structure, our authority, go back deep, deep, deep. Imagine we have been everything, but also to pull up everything we've ever practiced, you know, everything we've ever studied and tease it into practice. Like, what would it mean to practice that now? It's a time. Pisces is the realm of, in the collective, you know, what have we forgotten that we must remember? Saturn says wise leadership. Very often wise leadership derived from nature, good idea. And what has any mainstream culture imprisoned, exiled, dissed, undervalued, but is of great value? So Pisces is a part of our conversation that is quite radical. It says, oh humans, remember things. Oh humans, you know, what has been dissed, hidden, undervalued, imprisoned, exiled, that's where the beauty is. Go for that. So we might say really all of us are empathic outsiders with insider connections. It's a clue. It's a clue. So in the sky, Pluto, 60-degree angle to Neptune. In Aries, Saturn just having retrograded back. Okay, they're dancing. So the whole pulse is action, vision, visionary activism. There we go. And Saturn and Neptune then sextile Uranus, who is stationing. And just for the fun of it, just complex patterns, Uranus is, let's see, Pluto in the sky is now exactly where Uranus was when the first visionary activist show aired. I think it's ready to mature. So when the visionary activist show first aired, September 5th, 1996, Uranus was at 1 degree Aquarius. Pluto is now at 1 degree Aquarius, and we go, all right, let's get wilder, let's get deeper, let's go down. So in many, many ways. So Pluto to Neptune to Uranus, Uranus trines back to Pluto. It's an extraordinary opportunity out of the cauldron of sorrow and ashes and death and rebirth and cruelty and authoritarianism. Let's ladle out, you know, a true revolution of equality, equality, you know. And I have been watching the series Turn, which is Bob Goff, great ally, a member of the Ouija board of directors. He's gone on to that realm. You know, the last words he said to me as he went out the door, be sure and watch the series Turn about spies in the Revolutionary War. I'm like, I will. Then he went off and he died. But so Turn, I do recommend it. I'm on my third watching. It's not complete, but it is a pretty good historic animation, compelling storytelling with great nuance and complexity and charismatic evil and nuance going how tiny that experiment of the American Revolution was, you know, how befoibled, right? How betrayal, you know, that George Washington did promise those enslaved that if they fought for the Revolutionary War, he would free them. And afterwards, he was like, it's just not the right time. And I think part of how we understand the monstrosities before us and the Trump thing and the Trump regime and the Peter Thiels and the oligarchy and the Vance and the, and the Miller and the, is I'm not really comfortable with the hate fest and the death watch exactly, reasonable reactions. But it's a monstrous animation of America's shadow, of all the betrayal or all the hypocrisy of not living up to the ideal. And so Neptune chimes in and says, dissolution is the secret of the great work. Solve et coagula, dissolve and reimagine. As Rev. Ike said, if we can dream it up, we can dream it down. So we want to step into our responsibility for participating in dreaming the desirable world into being, right? And to acknowledge that all authoritarianism everywhere in the world is a monstrous animation of unaddressed shadow. And certainly America's shadow has been addressed. Howard Zinn, many people, KPFA, okay, we do, but not enough. It wants more revelation, more illumination. Because part of the Uranus dynamic, Pluto to Neptune to Uranus, Uranus trines back to Pluto, it behooves us to dance with the opportunities being so generously proffered to us, lest we leave it by default to the Dementors. It could easily be, again, what we see, the Peter Thiel, the Palantir, the information technology tyranny. What can we do? We can step into it, being agents of revelation. Dancing with trickster, dancing with trickster against all odds. Hillman's very up for this. You'll hear it in the show, absolutely. And so to ladle out of this cauldron of ashes, a renaissance. We're in Act Four of five acts. Remember that Jupiter chimes in to remind us the power of storytelling and blessing that of the five-act structure of storytelling. Four acts is tragedy, five acts is comedy, not ha-ha, but redemption. So Act One is here we are. Act Two is away. Woo! Act Three is oops, uh-oh. Act Four is evil. Oh, where the Dementors seem to be winning. And Act Five is the cultural renaissance, the wedding, the redemption. So it behooves all of us to be dedicated to crafting and animating and living Act Five, which of course is simultaneous. 72% of the world's governments are authoritarian now, not the people, the governments, right? And at the same time, we see this, people, actual community ra rising, aroused, mutual aid, ingenuity. That's the revolution that's happening. That's the revolution that we want to align with. Absolutely. So Uranus is stationing. Here we go. What goes well with Turn, spies in the Revolutionary War, can go on and on about that, but I won't. Just useful. What it doesn't cover is because my city, Washington, D.C., I live in a little witch's house outside, but my city is besieged, of course. But there's great rousing community, great hip hop and music and play and ingenious. It's the antidote to tyranny. As is all of us who insource our authority, insource our Saturn, that we are self-possessed, therefore not possessed, merely possessed. And so for all of us who insource our authority, who get our goat back, we are sucking the chi out of outer authoritarianism. So everything we do for ourselves grants us the spiritual muscle tone to participate in doing that in the world. So there we have that. So here's our context. Uranus stationing, retrograde wants our attention. Where would we like genius? Where would we like against all odds? Absolutely. And then the next day after Uranus stations, it's all around now. It's all around now. We don't need to fetishize specificity. But then September 7th is the lunar eclipse at 15 plus Pisces, whose image is the Grail. Right, so we're calling in mythology and the purified heart, the elixir. So we won't mostly see the lunar eclipse in America because it happens during the day. But we'll feel it, right? And it's followed on Sunday, September 21st, by its partner, the solar eclipse, at 29 plus Virgo, whose image is an emergency call. One's attention goes to matters at hand. Yes, indeed. And then the day after that is the equinox. Well, all eclipses and equinoxes are celebrations of equality. We can have eclipses on this planet, the only planet we know of, because the sun and the moon are the same size visually in the sky. We won't always have eclipses because the moon is slowly moving away, but in a million years we won't have eclipses, but for now, yes. So it's part of why eclipses are so ecstatic. It's like, oh, ooh. And it really is about equality, the experiment on this planet to come into equality. And then, of course, we arrive at the equinox, equal night and day, which we can address with our fervent dedication, you know, equal, equal Mars and Venus, equal humans and the rest of our species, you know, equal, equal democracy, democracy, there we go. So we will set forth into this dynamic thing with our companion, James Hillman, thank you, whose Pluto is on the U.S. Sun. Here we go. Here's James Hillman.
Hey, Mercury Retrograde says live from the ancient future, from the ancestral spirit world, and from the capital of capital, Washington, D.C. This is a metaphysical news service. This is the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm Caroline Casey, your weaver of context. So, briefly, to weave a little bit of context into which I will make a nest for our intriguing guest. There are two strategical social change times this century as described by the planetary patterns. And the first time was 64 to 69. And the second time is right now. And it's a description of where we want new reinvented mythologies that speak to all of us. It's described as a Kairos moment, a fulcrum moment, where everything that everyone does really matters. So that reminds us of our theme for this show, that we are always voting for reality, and it is always better to create prophecy than live predictions. So into this context, let me introduce our guest, an Aries, therefore a cultural agent provocateur, freed from the illusion of picking one thing and doing it forever. He is the former director of the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, Jungian analyst. He's written a gazillion provocative, complex books that are in the libraries of most of the mythologically, psychically literate people I know. Before this most recent book, his book was written with Michael Ventura. We've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse. His forthcoming book, The Soul's Code, is completely delicious and completely appropriate to what we want to dive into about emerging cosmologies that speak to us. We welcome our first guest consciousness artist, James Hillman. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. That was a grand intro. Go, go, go.
Right. Or as your book actually says, let's get down.
Yeah, let's get down.
Let's get
right.
down. Let's get down to get up. There are many, many tasty things in your book. I found it also, having been a great fan of yours for many years, but this is a book in which you maintain your brilliance, but it's also completely tastily accessible. I mean,
it's aimed to be that way.
Right.
It's full of gossip,
yes.
Stories, anecdotes. The method is anecdotal. Tell people's life stories. I don't mean case histories now. I mean life stories. Especially stories of extraordinary people.
And especially, I thought one of the tastiest chapters actually was your chapter on growing down.
Mm-hmm.
That we have this ridiculous fixation on growing up. And in that chapter you talk about Josephine Baker, who's a completely interesting person. Do you want to tell a little more about Josephine
Baker?
Well,
Josephine Baker, you know, was born in this outcast hospital in East St. Louis. I mean, right at the bottom of everything for prostitutes, people with social diseases and all that. Her name was changed. She was kept naked by people who, when she was a little girl, she had the most horrible beginning of life. But already then, there was this magic in her. And it's that fact that you have some calling, some innate image that's already there, and it just unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. I mean, I call the thing the acorn theory. That we start with a little nucleus that doesn't ever leave us. And of course, we often go astray and close the door to it and don't hear it, but there's something there.
Right, and I guess also in the astrological language, it's the concept of Venus, that what we have an affinity for is a crucial clue in the spiritual detective novel of our life.
That's good, the detective novel of our life.
Yeah, we really want to reverence that. I also thought it was completely interesting that Josephine Baker, and you also talk about Judy Garland, And then somebody you don't talk about, Marilyn Monroe, but all three of them were Geminis.
Yes.
Again, this sort of Venus in America, Gemini fixation. But you contrast very nicely Judy Garland
and Josephine Baker.
And Josephine Baker,
right. Because Judy Garland tried, she was called a 2.5. She was already a star at 2.5. She couldn't get off the stage. The very first time she ever appeared, she sang Jingle Bells up in Minnesota in a small town with her with her sisters. But she fell down, and the end of her life was a horror. Whereas Josephine Baker entered society, she took on 11 adopted children. She fought for the free French, was awarded medals by De Gaulle. She came back to America and took part in the race revolution.
Civil rights.
That's right. Yeah, she was really a person who grew slowly down from the heights into the world. And Judy Garland was dragged into it. She never could quite grow down. So it makes a very good contrast between two people who were called from the beginning and followed their calling, but never, Judy Garland never could enter, could finally grow down. The idea of the myth, though, is an old one, that we start in heaven or we start elsewhere. We start in an invisible world, the soul does, and it grows down into this world. That's why it's so hard for small kids. It's hard for them to enter this world.
Well, of course, what you sort of set up in your previous book, we've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse, and amplify in this book is that wonderful turning of psychology on its head of the child, say, you use, you know, Winston Churchill, who grew up to be the greatest orator in Europe, and as a child was a pathetic, stuttering weenie. And, you know, psychology would say, oh, he overcompensated.
That's right.
And you say, no, he was daunted by his task.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was already there. His destiny was there. His task was there. He had to save the world through speech and writing, through words. So, of course, how could he do it? He mumbled and stumbled when he was little. Or Manoletti the bullfighter, another one, who was terrified when he was a little kid. Because in the imagination he carried in his image, he may not have been conscious of it, but his soul was conscious of the fact that at 30 he would be gored to death by a huge black bull.
Or as you put it also, too, I mean, if part of you as a little child knows that you're going to be facing two-ton bulls in the arena, you are going to cling to your mother's skirts.
Yeah.
You are going to be a little kind of weenie. But what I was also, where I took heart in this, and I think it's heartening to all of us, too, is that the idea that surely those moments of being daunted by our soul's task extend far beyond childhood. I mean, there are these moments at any point where we have, you know, angst.
Yes.
The image that Doris Lessing uses in a lot of her novels, like Shikasta, is that, you know, there are these spirit guides, there are these invisible parts that at moments of decision where orthodoxy would say, take the money, go for this successful route, our guides are going, no, you plan to do this because a crucial part of world goodness depends on this. And we're sort
of
besieged.
Very good. Crucial part of world good. You have something to do here.
Right.
And therefore there are risks and challenges. Now, we're living in a society that's all wrapped in security. All we can think of is pension plans, insurance policies, and the whole question that we are really insured from within by something else. Well, it used to be called providence, protective angel. We've lost all of that. We're simply exposed, thrown out into the world, abandoned, victim. We have a terrible psychological philosophy.
Except I think that the complete collapse of all systems, scheduled for February, by the way,
This
coming February. But, I mean, I think that they already are, and we all know that, but I think the revelation of that is sort of described by, you know, many patterns that we'll be diving into after you, alas, have left us on the show to founder for ourselves. But I think that part of the radical energy that's released is that people who have invested in being good, mm-hmm. which means following the orthodox external kind of what I call the reality police. You know, it's like, you know, I've been very good, I didn't do what I wanted, you know, and then it's surprise, no pension. You know, it's like the force of outrage at being had, you know, I think is an enormous thing to be tapped. And I think it's also in that sense of stress is when everything else collapses, it dives us into there's nothing left but magic. There's nothing left but the soul's calling. When the external structure falls apart.
And that may not be as magical as we think it is. I mean, I think that it appears already in all kinds of hints and suggestions and moments of falling in love, moments of sudden attraction, moments of symptoms, moments of unexplained phenomena. These things deserve much more attention than the usual path. The pressures on the usual path are enormous, and they're built tremendously of fear. If we could really build security. And most of what we read in the papers, most of the economics, is all built on future. It's futures. You know, what's going to happen? So you predict and plan for what's going to happen, which we don't know.
And with no sense, of course, of reverence, it's, you know, the Mayans' word for human is one who owes.
Good.
Now, we don't need to be quite so saturnine in terms of bloodletting and whatnot, but I think that's the difference you're also making between Josephine Baker and Judy Garland. Josephine Baker wanted to give her gifts to the world in every way, not just to get the golden ring.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
as she grew older, she grew low down into the world to take part in its social, political questions of justice and care and loving and duty and all those great virtues.
And I think a crucial part of that also that's very pertinent to now is that the important distinction between being unique, which certainly your book is a call for and speaks to that part of all of us, as opposed to being special. Because being
yes.
unique really invites everyone, it catalyzes everyone to be their unique selves, whereas being special or important is often humorless
celebrities,
new age celebrity, all that.
Celebrities are simply examples of the potential that people each have, not to be a celebrity, but to be valued.
Right.
To be exceptional.
Right.
It's that quality. Instead of seeing our pathologies first as simply what's wrong, we see our pathologies as callings to the exceptional, making us different.
Right. And there's a great Japanese saying, actually, that says that art is the tracks, not the animal. You know, that it's the visible evidence of somebody's growing down or their true art, and in a sense, it's not the point that you focus on.
Yeah, we do need these figures. You know, let me read one little section from early in the book.
Please.
We use these figures, these extraordinary figures. I mean, there's Minuan in here, Barbara McClintock, the scientist, Canetti, the Nobel winner, who tried to kill his sister when he was a little boy of four, Ingmar Bergman. There are endless numbers of stories of people's childhood.
And all
the
wonderful
ones
who do terribly in school. That's important to come back to that. That's very heartening.
Terribly in school.
Yes, right.
We use these figures as they are always used by culture to inspire ordinary lives by displaying their own potentialities. Extraordinary people excite. They guide. They warn. Standing as they do in the corridors of the imagination. Statues of greatness. Personifications of marvel and sorrow. They help us carry what comes to us as it came to them. That's the important thing. We need these figures, not because they made a lot of money or they're celebrities and got a lot of press, but we need our imagination sparked, enlivened.
Yeah, and the great part also when you do the incredibly tasty chapter on people who just do terrible and orthodox things and terrible in school especially, and the wonderful story about Truman Capote, whose mother, you know, couldn't get him at all and really hated him, but he had the mentor, that important thing. And that wonderful point that you quote where the mentor sits down with Truman Capote's mother and she's complaining about him, and she says, "Yes, but Mrs. Capote, all those little boys that you want your son to be so much like who do ordinary things in years, they'll still be doing ordinary things, but Truman will be famous." Very tasty and satisfying.
Very,
it's like
very sweet.
Very sweet.
And the teacher who saw James Baldwin.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a woman from Ohio who had this job in a Harlem public school, and there's this little 10-year-old boy. And she was astounded. They began to talk about Dickens together. And they had a kind of love between them that went on for years. 40 years later, he wrote her a letter, and she wrote him back, and so on and so forth. Maybe not quite 40 years. But the point is that there's an eye that falls in love with the imagination of the other person, and they see each other, and that's what's needed. And your parents can't always see you. It's not their job to see you. It's their job to get the cornflakes on the table, to put a roof over your head, to get some shoes on your feet. But it isn't necessarily that your mother or your father can see you.
Right.
And it's our job, older people, to see younger people.
Yes,
to see
exactly.
their beauty, to see their imagination, and to bless it.
And ideally, of course, that's what the intuitive arts or the astrological arts were always meant to be. I mean, they've been, you know, malpracticed. But I think it's that crucial part that you mentioned about being seen as food nutrient, you know, actually be perceived, you know, by another deeply and profoundly. You know,
you go to the astrologer to have that part of your soul seen.
I think that's what it should be in its highest level,
which isn't personal. the person doesn't need to know you intimately, personally.
Right, which is, yeah, which is why the experience of so many people who have a good astrological reading is, oh, I am who I think I am.
Yes.
What a relief.
What a relief.
What a relief. I really am. My interior life really is real, even though it has never been seen or validated before.
And in the normal psychology world, we've lost that. You see, we try to see people through tests.
Right. Nightmare. Sociological,
sociological, statistical.
Yeah. Nightmare.
And diagnostic.
Right.
And you don't see the soul with that.
No. And you flatten the soul with that, yeah.
Or you avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
You avoid it. And the symptoms, which then, in other words, what then gets repressed, the soul which is repressed or not seen, has to rebel through symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the book is full of the peculiarities of the people, of all the anecdotes.
Right.
Because that's where the unusual appears.
But I think also in the astrological language, it would say that it's sort of the alchemy of what does something want to be, and that things grow toxic by being suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ask, you know, here's this, you know, strange, kinky thing. What did it want to be before it grew toxic,
that's right,
due to being exiled from the society, from the psyche society, or from the larger society? And I think part of the theme of now is that we want the awakened imagination of everyone to kind of pull off a dreaming a better world into being. And for me, one of the kind of marvels was working with bad delinquent kids using mythology and astrology and magic and so on. What I found was that they were incredibly mythologically literate, but
yes,
underfed.
You but know, underfed.
Underfed. They'd never been talked to about you can actually have an effect on your life. You can find your powerful daemon. You can find your power animal. And after a little bit of cynicism, what I found was that they were just incredibly skilled. It was intrinsic, and that there's some part of that puzzle that we've exiled those parts of human imagination that we most need.
You know, what is it we're afraid of? What is it that the school system, the politically correct world, the normal bourgeois, non-magical world is so afraid of?
Well, I call it the reality police, which is that there's that part of any group, no matter how hip or not, that would rather die than change. You know, and that it sort of snookers us into complicity in our own self-suppression. It's sort of the illusion of saying, well, after the revolution, we'll have the state, and then that will wither away, of course. And it's like, no. That structures want to maintain themselves and therefore edit out the disruptive.
The structures want to maintain themselves. I would say it's an archetypal force that's always there, a Saturnian force.
Of
wanting to consolidate,
right,
and keep what is.
Right.
And not yield.
Of course, the language of astrology that says Aquarius, human community, is governed or has an affinity for Saturn, stability, and Uranus, innovation and change. The truly stable community, of course, is the one that invites and welcomes in the unique creativity of the individual, I think, which is really what your book is a kind of argument for.
It is about that, but don't forget, my book also touches the shadow, that there
mm-hmm.
can be a bad seed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an entire chapter on murderers,
yep,
on Hitler, on Dahmer.
Right.
On the people there are several murderers in England, the greatest serial murderer in the Ukraine. So it does analyze the problem of how do we understand a calling to tremendous destruction.
But I wasn't even clear after actually reading that chapter. I mean, do you think that was intrinsically fated or it wanted to be something else?
I think nothing has to be. Nothing's all pre-planned.
No fixed future.
There's no fixed future.
Right, yeah.
It's not pre-planned. There's no map. There's a calling. There's some tremendously powerful, destructive mystery that does appear in some people.
But perhaps also that's one of the definitions, in a sense, of art and ritual, that whatever we ritualize, we need not live out as a melodrama.
Of course.
The cultures that have contained, ritualized aggression in their dances need not, literalize those.
Absolutely. And I do suggest at the end of that chapter that there are ways to work with these things. But that's not an easy question, and I don't want to escape into thinking that everybody...
And one caller said, interesting, illuminating about Hitler, but didn't explain it. I don't have any more clue to give you, James, than that. Explain Hitler. Gee, they're not asking for much, huh?
You'd have to, I hate to say it, but you'd have really to read as much as I read in order to begin to get a handle on it. I'm certainly not going to have the pretension to explain Hitler in a sentence. It's a deep mythical possession and I give an enormous amount of evidence to show the mythological background that was there very early in his life.
What I also am interested in, too, is this concept of, without shame or blame, of complicity, that we all are, in fact, related. What I liken it to also is, you know, postal workers who go crazy. It's as though there are pressures that are unaddressed in our culture that push down and that erupt through the most sensitive or vulnerable or thinnest membrane, which we could say is psychic, psychotic, very close together, unusual people who are open to possession by mythic archetype, or just people who've just are vulnerable and had a bad day, and they explode in a sense for all of us. So that we don't go, ooh, look evil over there, but in a sense are invited to go, how is this, you know, an externalization of a complicity that we're all engaged in, I think, is part of it.
That's the collective unconscious that breaks through,
right,
to use a term. But I agree completely that it is something, a complicity that we're all involved in.
Right.
And at that time in history, it was not only the German people who were involved in, who were complicitous with Hitler.
That's right. Absolutely. But I also want to quote a little bit from your book, too. First, the sort of setup is Nabokov, in his lectures on literature, said that the history of science is the history of exploded, ridiculous theories. And James Hillman adds in his book also, too, the cosmologies of today, big bangs and black holes, antimatter and curved, ever-expanding space going nowhere, leave us in dread and senseless incomprehensibility. Random events, nothing truly necessary. Science's cosmologies say nothing about the soul, and so they say nothing to the soul. It's like, I love that part. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's, you know, very much yes. And that in that sense of complicity, you know, I mean, you are a part of all of us that is saying this for all of us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what science is telling us now about the new genetic idea, that's why this book is called The Soul's Code, because what we get is the genetic code. And when you go into the genetic code today, it also, no one is necessary. There is no reason for anyone to be here.
And is therefore, the amoral tampering and tinkering. I mean,
you can do anything you want with that genetic mm-hmm. code because there's no inherent necessity in anyone's life.
Right.
We are simply victims of a biological progression, beginning who knows when. And so we get rapturous over finding some life on Mars a billion years ago, if then. What the hell difference does it make? Really, what difference? It only matters if that's your theory of what's important.
But if we add the mythological, I mean, I always read the New York Times through the mythological lens and go, oh, culture wants to talk about Mars.
Oh, well, that's fine.
In that sense, it's like, all right, culture is struggling to talk about Mars,
yes.
Which is now conjunct Venus.
Now
it is conjunct Venus in the sky. The image, actually, the Sabian symbol for Mars right now is the Indian girl introducing her white lover to the tribe. I think it's about this syncretism and mixing, and part of also where I felt a profound affinity with your book, and certainly what I'm up to as well, is that you're talking about the cosmology of the invisibles and the
yes.
invisible world.
Yes.
And in a sense, what I call visionary activism is the kind of alliance with the invisible world of
yes.
evolutionary intelligence, what wants to happen, and this active offering of ourselves to it. Or to those parts of it with which we have an affinity.
But just bringing the word invisibles back into the culture is very difficult. I mean, 30 years ago, I wrote a book called Suicide and the Soul, more than 30 years ago, and it brought the word soul back into the culture. It was, of course, in the culture in the street, soul brother, soul food, soul music, of course. But basically, soul was not in psychology anywhere.
Right.
And soul is now there. The invisibles have to come back the
right.
same way.
And I think it's also where politically active, left-leaning, liberal people, in a sense, we want to address that or redress that, but they gave the whole issue of spirituality completely to the right wing
yes.
for fear of being mocked as silly.
Yes.
You know, the liberal fear of being accused of possibly having a spiritual life, you know, completely blew the whole game.
Or being... being not rational.
You right. See, the terrible accusation.
Secular. I can't go into that. But that's the bankruptcy. That's the bankruptcy
that's right.
of the left.
And what I think also is that the one thing that kind of compassionate social activism has not had is what I call magic, in the sense of magic simply being an experimental opening to the invisible. You know, and saying, all right, what wants to happen? How do we ally ourselves?
But you know, all the you're talking again and again about white bread culture, but the rest of American culture, Santeria,
yeah, absolutely,
the world of the Caribbean, the world of the African American, the world of of the Creole. And so it's rich with all this.
Completely.
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 It has no problem with the invisible
or
being open to the effects of other things.
Absolutely.
It's only this strange, exclusive, narrow-minded white bread culture. So when Hillary Clinton talks to...
Poor woman trying to have a little...
Eleanor Roosevelt.
Right.
A splendid woman of our century.
And who doesn't talk to Eleanor?
Yeah,
yes,
and to who doesn't talk to someone?
Yes.
To someone, a grandfather, a grandmother, someone. There are constant figures in our dreams and passing figures whom we need to help carry our lives.
Right.
She's mocked. But who mocks her, really?
Only, I think, a very, 0.001% of the people controlling the media spigot.
That's right.
I think that the population was like, yeah, right.
And
who doesn't suck toes either?
Exactly.
Big deal.
Yeah, big deal.
Right, big deal.
Precisely.
Talk to Eleanor Roosevelt and suck toes all the time. I mean, in Santeria, with which I have a great respect and affinity, actually, the idea of the Loa are always riding, piggybacking on us.
Yes.
And it's also part of my take about here we have this huge cultural syncretism, cross-fertilization, really for the biggest time in 500 years of cultures mixing. And the view, in a sense, is that the Loas, the invisibles of different cultures, want to dance together.
Yes.
500 years ago, they could only piggyback on the back of thugs. And so it was a very crude and warlike,
They want to dance together.
They
That's
want.
Good.
Yes,
yeah.
They want to dance together. And so, in a sense, it's our task to create art forms and rituals to allow them to dance so that it's acted out on that level rather than, and also this idea of immigration being welcomed as, more gods, more fruitfulness, more color, more flavor.
Well, the whole question of immigration is basic. The immigrant is the most American of all people because he comes here with a dream.
Absolutely.
America is a dream. America is... A religion. America is a fantasy. America is a hope. America is an abstraction that people came to from the very beginning and still come.
And
for
needs
that.
The replenishment of that.
And die to get here on rafts, on canoes, on a boat, in all sorts of ways. The most American people are the ones who are struggling to get here. Though the rest of us who've been here for 100 years or longer are no longer really Americans. We're economists. We're consumers. We're not Americans.
Right.
Americans live a faith, a dream, a hope, a vision.
Right. Completely right.
Yeah.
No, there was a great commentary. I forgot who it was. Out of San Francisco, and he was addressing the issue of immigration and saying, these people come with a dream. He said, I have a greater affinity with those who still have a dream than with those who have forgotten how to dream.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah, so also, I like also in your book where you talk about the Nagual, that these are spirits that accompany us. And I think part of what's crucial about your book and this idea of its tremendous accessibility, and I suppose you get to actually take all the intellectuals along with you because because you've earned that credit. You're a kind of undercover agent that's been trained to cross bridges and say, okay, intellectuals, you're allowed to talk about spirits now.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
As well as everybody else. So it's a kind of liberation in that sense. So,
I've earned my credentials to.
You have.
Right. It is not, in that sense, it doesn't belong, it's not a New Age book, but it presents a vision that we absolutely must have to counter the kind of reductive, rationalistic psychology based on the diagnostic statistical manual and things
right.
of that sort.
So
which is ending up drugging the kids of the culture.
Oh, completely.
Drugging the kids of the culture.
Right.
And setting up an enormous drug, favoring an enormous pharmaceutical industry, drugs to which you can't say no.
Well, yes, I mean, there's never been any such thing as a drug-free culture. I mean, there never will be. It's a question of which drugs are allowed,
exactly.
which kind of support the status quo. And also, they're wonderful sort of reading science metaphorically also, too. Well, not even metaphorically in this case, but I guess it was last year, a year and a half ago, scientists discovered that at the center of the universe, they'd found this huge, or the galaxy, cloud of laughing gas. So the whole thing's a joke. And then they found this huge cloud of ethyl alcohol. So we're waiting for the giant spliff somewhere, but there's no such thing as a drug-free universe. But exactly, in the astrological language, Neptune would be, that yearning of the soul, that dream, that vision. And Neptune, we draw like a trident, and it says, well, what happens to a person or a culture when there is no living dream, when the soul is not respected? Then it gets hooked on Neptune's trident, gets addicted to anything to numb the pain of alienation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, any of those kinds of drugs. But the alchemy would say, you know, let's feed that. I mean, you do not, by suppressing anything, of course, it grows more toxic. So
that's a very basic idea.
Crucial.
We know that you can't keep gas in a container too long. You can't put garbage in a container too long. It explodes. It forms its own gases and so on. And Freud said repression, you know, will out. The repressed returns.
Well, it's the bad fairy not invited to the party.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a deep archetypal truth that repression is not the way.
And yet, our culture, of course, says build more prisons, do the, you know, again,
yes.
You know, hide the toxic waste, push it down until it seeps out of the edges, and treat a considerable proportion of our young people as though they were toxic waste.
And also, let's move forward. That very sentence, let's put that behind us. George Bush's famous sentence.
Let's put that behind us?
Put that behind us. That is repression.
Right.
We tried to put everything behind us, and we can't.
Mm-hmm.
We can't even put the war between the states. The Civil War continues to return again and again and again.
Right. And it's that idea, if we can shove something into invisibility, being an invisible, illiterate culture, then it doesn't exist.
And we give it over to the invisibles, and they don't want it. There are things we need to deal with in our visible world.
Right. But it's also this interesting concept of sudden, which is a kind of Uranus concept, which is suddenly something happened, or suddenly the bridge collapsed, or suddenly, you know, this broke out. And what it is really something was always there, but invisible, kind of below the horizon, and then suddenly, in quotes, it emerges, but it was always there.
Good.
It was always happening there.
Right.
You know, and again, so sudden is a complete illusion. I mean, I expect that there will be many sudden events of collapse of infrastructure, you know, it's there now for anybody who wants to see and begin to address it and speak to it. But I think also that what's crucial to what we're all up to and what you're up to in your book is that I think Pluto, okay, in Sagittarius, just to throw in some language, would remind us that we once, as humans, lived in a world of primordial intimacy in which it was understood that everything was telling its story, everything was talking.
Yes.
And that whatever we talked to would talk back.
Yes.
And I think the crucial part also of the kind of subversive magic that you're up to, that we all want to be up to, is that anybody who reads your book, you're talking to parts of them that will not go back to sleep.
And I have had already, and the book is just out, I've already had the people tell me, strangers. One wrote me, one spoke on the phone from Michigan, one from somewhere else. Someone sent me a fax that it absolutely turned their life upside down.
Mm,
now, there's nothing practical in the book. In other words, telling you how to do this and how to do that.
That's really turned
their philosophy upside down.
Right.
I want to say, let me read one more thing.
Please.
Because there's so many exceptional lives in this book. It's full of anecdotes of people's stories. We need to emphasize the exceptional in a society that now, owing to a reverse snobism, is enthralled with the ordinary. With the newly knighted, hard-working, tax-paying, moral and deserving middle class. Think of those as metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
If the society suffers a loss of soul, a loss of daimonic inspiration, of angel and genius, then before starting off in search of them, why not ask what might be driving them away? What's keeping the angel and the genius from entering our lives? Maybe inviting mediocrity in, just doing a passable job as a team player, not upsetting the boat, holding on to family values, joining the Walmart community, staying cool, fearing extremists and ungrounded underground ideas, is precisely what drives the invisibles away. Instead of asking, how can I get in touch with them, think how you're already committed to a pattern that doesn't allow them in.
But it's like there's a Haitian saying that says, when the anthropologist arrives, the gods depart.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar idea, this idea of reverence as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, it's a party, I think. I mean, part of how I describe also the patterns of what we're moving into is that, you know, everything, every part of ourselves that has not been invited to the mainstream party wants in, and every part of the culture that has not been invited to the mainstream party wants in. And we need this vision that includes the best of all traditions.
We have the vision. It's the melting pot.
All right.
We do have the vision.
Well, yes, we do. Absolutely, we do. But what wants to be given maybe more voice or honored or invited in more is this idea. I just remember interview with one of the Islamic mullahs who was very rabid and very deaf to Salman Rushdie and so on. But at the end of the interview, he said, well, actually, here's the deal. If Islam were not so dissed, the the blood pressure of all the mullahs would go way down.
Exactly.
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 So again, the inviting of the best of most of the, of all these traditions. There's a wonderful thing in the Quran in which Gabriel's talking to Muhammad and said, you know, we could have had no evil at all if we'd made you all alike. But God would have none of it and insisted that each creature be unique. And so evil is the price of uniqueness in the experiment of coming into accord with uniqueness rather than sameness.
That's very good.
Yeah.
That's a nice one. Where is that?
It's the Quran.
Gabriel talking to Muhammad. That's very good.
Talking about, we could have had no evil if we're all the same.
Yeah.
But God would have none of it.
And that's the problem with the melting pot. We want to take the chilies out of it and turn it all into corn chowder.
Right, right, right. And again, yeah. See, the subversive thing, I think, that this is, all of this is great, is that I often underpress myself by walking down the street and going, okay, everyone has a Neptune. Everyone has a yearning, a
that's
dream.
It.
Everyone
that's
has
right.
a Uranus, a unique part. Talk to that, bypass
everyone
their conscious
has a
mind.
Pluto.
Everyone has a Pluto.
Yeah.
Yes,
and that
absolutely.
Pluto, that there again, if we come in touch with that seed that's so mysterious.
Yes.
Yeah.
And to speak to that and to invite that, and even though Pluto, of course, is expensive wisdom. I was talking to somebody with Pluto very strong in their life, and they said, do you know the Japanese poem that says, since my house burned down, I have a much better view of the rising moon. And that's Pluto's gift.
Mm-hmm,
But yeah, no, everyone has that. But I think the subversive part is, again, when we speak to that and pitch it,
yes.
Even invisibly, we just invisibly talk to that part of it. It is hungry, it quickens, it wakes up, and it won't go back to sleep, and it won't let that person go back to sleep.
Exactly.
Which I think also about you lobbing this book. I mean, part of what I say about Uranus and Aquarius is that it is time to lob liberating esoterica into mainstream.
And but you see what happens.
Well, what
simply,
happens?
Well, I mean, Hillary Clinton does one little conversation with imaginary Eleanor Roosevelt,
right.
And she's scoffed.
Right.
Well, of course, that's part of the attack on Hillary Clinton and all. But there's still in this white bread culture a terrible fear.
Yeah.
A terrible, straight-laced, peculiar fear.
Well, let's kick it open.
Good.
So here we are, team, on the other side of the Hillman Show, which continues to resonate. Yes, oh, thank you, James Hillman, for being part of the Ouija Board of Directors. That's really great. This being the 30th anniversary of the Visionary Activist Show, which I want to do all homage to Asada Iman, who was the program director at KPFA, who called me up out of the blue more than 30 years ago and said, we got a huge response from playing your recordings for Sounds True on the air, and would you like to have a show? And Pacifica is difficult to work with, and they don't pay you any money. And I go, that's perfect. I know exactly what I want to do. So thank you, Asada Iman, right, for all of that. And just to pick up again, James Hillman, let's get down to get up. So I'd mentioned TURN, the Revolutionary War. We go, that's good. What it leaves out, it's a war story. It's a great war story. It's a really pertinent to us now war story. But it leaves out the esoteric part of it. And there's a fabulous book, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, by a great late colleague, also part of the Ouija Board of Directors, David Ofsen, his pen name. And it's not a New Age flaky book. It's a real book about how the city of Washington was designed by Masons. George Washington, all his generals were Masons. Everybody was a Mason, up to FDR was a Mason. And so they designed the city on purpose to have powers within it, knowing that it had not fulfilled its promise. The top of the pyramid is not settled yet, but to call upon at a time of great danger. We go, now would be really good. So they did everything by ritual. The whole capital was designed east-west to be in accord with the equinoxes. It's kind of like a large Stonehenge. The capital dome was designed specifically, to be a place of wisdom coming down, wise leadership coming down. Boy, the Masons must be pissed off. We're calling on them. And they said the radiant eye represented the invisible presence of the great architect, spiritual being, invited by prayer and ritual to oversee the ceremony. When they lay the foundation stone, which is deep in the earth with ceremony, everything connected to Virgo, right? And then the keystone is the on top stone to invite the chthonic powers of the earth up into the building itself. So much esoterica. We'll be talking more about it for fun, but here we are. To go humming, many things to be called upon. You know, there's many great things in the city of Washington, D.C. that are latent to be brought alive, like so much right now, so many mythologies, High John the Conqueror, the trickster redeemer of the South, and King Arthur, they go away, you know, to await the world's call at a time of danger. And we go, now would be really good, calling on everything, you know, to come on out. And so we close now with wonderful the Bengtsons and their song Hope Comes, which is really feisty solace offered to us. There we go. Ah, the wolves are howling. I will go give a parade for our, we will go give a parade for ourselves on the beach. Thank you, team. Woof, woof, woof.
Hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope come from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope come from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes.
The part of you that is not all right, yeah, is also the part that is the part that calls in change, and you don't have to feel ashamed. There is nothing to forgive. The part of you that is crying out is the part that wants to live, yeah.
Hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes.
When your world is burning down, well, getting hot is a sane reaction, but one in need of action, because your spirit needs protection. So gather up your sinew and gather up your affection. Hey. Hope is not a feeling. Hope is an action. Hey.
I said, hope comes from the place where the hurt comes. I said, hope.
Fall down on